want to welcome everyone here this morning to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case that will be argued at 9 o'clock, and we have two more that will be argued at 10:30. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the panel members. To my left is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my right is Justice Bill Meyer.
Good morning.
And I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. And I understand that both attorneys are here and ready. So if the clerk will call the case, please.
The court will now call Ex parte Charles Barber, and may it please the court, Mr. Toby and Lopez to argue for the appellant, Mr. Stephen Baker to argue for the state.
You may begin.
May it please the court.
Good morning, Justices. I'm brought here today by following a roadmap that this court presented to me and asked me to follow in order to bring about change in what is a terribly written, terribly crafted, and outdated law. I'm going to go through my points, four points this morning, and I'll address each one, and I will welcome your feedback. But I'll begin with point one from the brief, which says that section 4207A7, and this is specifically the section that deals with electronic communications, is vague, it is confusing, it uses words that are subjective in their terms, and it is easily enforced differently by different members of the law enforcement community. So when we start off, we talk about a term such as annoy. What does annoy mean? Well, I'd use the Weird Al defense when talking to Judge Vanover when it comes to that. I myself find Weird Al's music to be annoying. I'm an educated gentleman. I think I'm a pretty good lawyer. My brother Delano is a teacher at Ohio State. He's equally educated. He's much smarter than I am, and he loves Weird Al Yankovic. He thinks his music's fabulous. Which one of us is correct?
Your brother.
My brother? I figured you might say that. But that's the problem, isn't it? He might think that I like Tupac, and he thinks Tupac's annoying. You know, annoying is such a vague, bad term, and especially when it comes to this new technology that we're dealing with. What is annoying in a text, in memes, in GIFs? We've got a guy at the courthouse here that sends us these GIFs all day long, every day. To me, I blow it off because, well, Goza's just Goza. My boss, Ed, is like, God, Goza's annoying me again. He meant to send those texts. He meant to send those gifts. But is it harassment? It's interesting that harassment is one of the terms that we're arguing about today, especially today with the Me Too movement. For years, conduct that seemed okay in all these different industries, he's not harassing her. He just said she's got pretty eyes. Well, now we're saying, well, maybe harassment means something different to different people. Obviously it does. And so how do I know? Am I harassing someone? If I send my girlfriend a text, hey, you're beautiful. Am I harassing her? Well, maybe she's mad at me that day. When I send my son a text, hey, Ashton, go mow the lawn. Did you mow the lawn? Stop playing video games, go mow the lawn. I'm intending to harass my son. Under this law, as it's written now, as vague as it is, I am criminally liable for telling my son to go mow the lawn. Because I intend to harass him. Yeah, I'm harassing him to go mow the lawn. I sent him three texts yesterday. Did you mow the lawn? It's still not mowed when I left this morning. Okay, it's a bad law because of that.
Counsel, can I ask you if there's anything in the recent U.S. Supreme Court case of DiMaia that would help us understand your vagueness argument?
I'm not familiar with that case, Judge, so I can't tell you if there is or there isn't. But I would suggest that as we deal with this, that under both the Texas Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, it is unconstitutionally vague, and it encourages seriously discriminatory law enforcement. Again, the theft statute's very clear. If I go into Walmart, I shove three frozen pizzas in my jacket and run out the door. 10 officers are all going to arrest me for theft. There's no room for interpretation there. They're all going to say, yes, spies, you can't steal those pizzas. You can't grab them and run out. It's very clear. In this, again, if I send a text to my ex-wife saying, hey, it's your turn to make the insurance payment this month, did you pay the insurance payment this month? Well, some officers might say, Tobias, you're harassing her. Some might say, no, it's her job to pay it. So in that case, it is very discriminatory in how a law enforcement officer might address this particular statute.
Do you concede that your point, your third point, we don't have jurisdiction over, as the state contends? Or do you disagree with that?
Well, I would disagree. In point number three, you're mm-hmm. addressing the charging instrument.
Mm-hmm. Since there's been no guilty finding.
I would say that we still have the right under the law to know what exactly we're defending against. And if you look at the charging instrument, it's very incomplete. When we have a assault deadly weapon, it's very clear to us. You used a gun to commit that crime. It's very clear. I shot somebody in the knee. Very clear. In this, I've been looking at this case for 3 years. I still don't know what I'm defending against. Is it a text? Is it an email? Was it repeated on this day? Is each count an example of what is repeated?
Would it be your contention that the charging instrument should contain the allegedly annoying, harassing?
Absolutely.
And so you think that they should list all of the emails and text messages that would form the basis of the charge?
Absolutely, Judge.
In the indictment.
You are 100% correct that it should absolutely tell me, was it this text, was it annoying to say, Mona, you need to pay the car insurance bill? Or was it, hey, Junior, skip class today, and I told him not to skip class and you said it was okay? I have no idea. When there are thousands of texts that were sent within this time period, hundreds of emails, I have no idea which one I'm defending against. In 3 years, I still don't know. So there's a problem there in that I can't, he's going to be found guilty, maybe, because I don't know what I'm defending against. I'm going to walk into court blind. After 3 years, it still does not tell me, like it should. Like in a theft statute, it would say, he stole tennis shoes, he stole bread, he stole a six-pack of Coca-Colas. They do that in a theft information. There's nothing here. It parrots the language. And as I say in point three, it needs to be better when there are subjective intent onto the manner and the means. So I think that you can address point three, Your Honor. But I'd like to go back to point two. As we say in the First Amendment, statute must be sufficiently definitive so it does not chill freedom expression. That's Long versus State. The statute is not definitive. The Texas Constitution, no law shall ever be passed curtailing the liberty of speech. Charles doesn't know what he could or could not do. I don't know what I could or could not do. You guys don't know what you could or could not do. If Justice Souther sends you guys an email saying, hey, your robes were a little dusty today, get them clean, and then you don't do it, and then she sends you another one next week, hey, I asked you to get your robes clean, she might be in violation of this statute if you find that to be annoying.
But I would never do such a thing.
Well, I don't know, you might be a tough boss. I'm not sure how you operate. So but again, we're talking about communication between people that have a relationship, and that is protected speech. It's not about strangers. In Charles's case, it's about a woman who's suing him in civil court to try to get money because he's the cash cow. She's using any weapon she can, and she's realized she can use this statute as it's written to try to gain leverage in civil court when it comes to getting more money.
Counsel, I realize that this doesn't really affect your legal argument one way or another, but was there any evidence in the record that exists so far? I guess there's really not, but that the wife told him to stop at any point?
There's nothing in the record because I have not yet had the chance to cross-examine her. So when the record, if this should go to trial, that will be included in the record. But as the record as it is not concluded. But again, I think the courts have not, in any of the case law that I've read regarding Texas specifically, they haven't really drilled down on this hard enough and under the proper standard of review of to it being the First Amendment, because I think they're trying to create a whole new category in what's an evolving, you know, we're evolving when it's, when we're dealing with text and email. We had to create emojis to make sure we're sending the right type of message, right? That's why emojis evolve, because it is arbitrary, because you can read something very differently. And it's gotta be specific, and it's gotta be evolving. This statute should be rewritten every session because the technology is evolving. If you look at the original, the statute, the definitions, where it talks about what types of communications are permitted, or electronic communication, for instance, communication made to a pager. Communication made to a pager. When's the last time any of you had a pager? 10 years? 12 years? But that's the language still in the statute. Communication initiated by electronic mail, instant message, network call, or facsimile machine. So we're talking about fax machines. Nowhere in here does it mention Snapchat, Instagram. It doesn't even mention text message, honestly, because it defines the other ones. Our canons of construction say if you define these, then you don't mean these. They haven't updated the statute to even include cell phone communication. Under it, as it's written right now, a text message is not covered in this. If you read just the literal words, because cellular communication is not mentioned. It mentions wire, radio, electronic communication, electromagnetic, photoelectronic, photo-optical. It says it means those types of communication, how you send it, the manner in which it's sent. It doesn't say cellular sending. It doesn't say text message. It doesn't say Instagram. But surely they intend that, but they haven't updated it. It's outdated law, and it's vague. And again, if you want to say a text message is not covered in this statute the way it's written. Look very clearly at the definition section. It is not defined. And because it's defined elsewhere, what is our Latin term for that? I wrote it down so I would remember. Expresso unius est excluso alterius, right? We learned that in legislation regulation class in law school and forget about it. But again, it's just, the whole point is what this court has said before. It's bad law. It's vague. And it doesn't apply to A4. You know, you're going to hear talk about LIBO and those other decisions that have been made. And they say, well, it was good enough for A4, good enough for A7. Well, A4 is very different. A4 is hard landline telephone communication. And the manner that you can communicate with a landline telephone is very different from that cell phone I've got in my bag over there. I can't send you a video through a hard line. I can't send you an email through a hard line. I can't send you an emoji, a GIF, a meme, any of those types of communication. So it's very different, and it's very flawed, and it's very, 2001 thinking to try to compare the text of A4 to A7. Because the capabilities between a landline and a cell phone or an electronic email communication are huge. They're vastly different. And that's, again, it's so broad that the statute needs to narrow down exactly what is prohibited under A7. And for LIBO to try to say, oh, A4 and A7, the language is the same, so it's the same. I mean, they're comparing landline communication with whether it's a cell phone, a laptop, an iPad, however you're communicating, they are completely different. There's no argument to be made there. The state, they're not going to argue that they're the same. So the language is the same, but the intent and the capabilities, the manner and means, are completely different when it comes to A4 and A7. So to try to equate A4 is good law, so that means A7 is good law, is just silly. And again, this court has already said, yes, A7's bad law.
Mr. Lopez, I'd like to understand your reasoning on the case of, I believe it's pronounced Karenev against the state. As you go through your analysis of what is a constitutional test for this statute. That case was...
This is the case that you guys presented, and it
was
overturned.
Well, it was presented by Justice Stofanoff.
This court ruled on.
In our court, and then it went to the Court of Appeals,
yes,
and was reversed.
It was reversed only on procedure, Your Honor. It was not reversed based on the law.
So we look
because
at cases.
Because Karenev didn't...
So your position is we look at cases and determine if the reversal was based on substance and R was based on procedure, and if it's reversed on procedure, then what is your belief in how it stands as precedent?
Well, I understand it's not precedent because it was overruled on procedure, but that doesn't change the substance of what this court said. And the argument doesn't change. This court said it is terrible law. It was void at birth, was the exact language used in Karenev. So just because Karenev didn't bring it up pretrial, which is what I did here today, which as I began and said, I'm following your roadmap. I'm following the roadmap to fix the procedural flaw in Karenev.
You take a look at how many justices.
Doesn't change
did
that.
You take a look at how many justices in the Karenev case remain on this court?
Yeah, oh, I know, McCoy. He's downstairs, and I understand that this is a completely different panel. But the logic doesn't change. And you're an intelligent man. You can respect the logic and the substance doesn't change.
I served with Justice Stofanoff for 9 years. Mm-hmm. I do respect her logic.
Absolutely.
But I don't always agree with
her. Well, I understand. That's why we've got three of you. But I believe I've used my time at this point, so I will yield to Stephen and prepare for rebuttal.
Thank you. Please give Mr. Baker one extra minute, please. Mr. Baker, I've got a question right off the bat.
Bet.
I see a difference between a landline and a cell phone in various respects. First is that you can turn off a landline, it's true, but it's cumbersome to do that. And if someone's ringing your landline, if anybody has landlines left, throughout the night, throughout the day, debt collectors, ex-husbands, whoever, just nosy neighbors, just people that you don't want to talk to, it can be distracting, annoying. It can encumber your ability to sleep or to function because your landline is there. It's ringing. Whereas a cell phone, you can turn it on silent. You can turn it off. You can block calls. You can block senders. You have control to a greater degree to prevent yourself from being harassed by just using defensive mechanisms with your phone. And certainly you can turn it off when you go to bed and turn it on when you get up in the morning. And so, to me, the cases that are dealing with landlines are unique because of the true ability to harass someone, not by the content of what's being said, but just by the mere fact that you're ringing that phone all the time, incessantly. And so I want you to address that because I think that I see that as a distinction in the cases that you cite, saying that this is okay.
Sure. Justice Sutter, and I guess I would respond by saying that, you know, there's two parts to this statute. Actually, there's three parts. There's the intent by the person that's making these calls or sending these text messages or sending these emails. And the third half is the person that's actually receiving, you know, whether they have to be annoyed, embarrassed. But it has to be a reasonable person standard. So objectively, would a person, if they can just turn their phone off, can they really be annoyed or embarrassed by that? Those, I guess, incessant emails are more likely with phones, with text messages.
Or if they could block them or send them to junk mail. I mean, we have a lot of control over.
And I think that would just go towards, if there were to be a trial, that would be something that the prosecutor and something for the jury, the fact finder, to decide.
But I'm really talking about the logic of the other cases that say that it's okay, that the statute's okay when it comes to telephone calls.
Right.
Does the logic hold with a cell phone?
Well, the four cases that I cited, or actually the two cases I cited, Reese and Lebo, they really don't make a clear delineation between the two. They just focus on whether it's behavior that's protected by the First Amendment. And all those cases focus on the reasoning in Scott v. State, which talks about how the individual sending the call has the specific intent to inflict emotional distress, and therefore it's not protected by the First Amendment at all. And so far, is there a difference? Yes, I think there is a difference. But I think the statute holds because of those two parts that I talked about. One being the intent by the person sending the text message or email, and the third part being the person actually receiving.
Would Twitter count?
Excuse me?
Would tweets count?
Would tweets count? Well,
I mean, some people would say the President of the United States is annoying them.
Right.
Would he be violating the Texas law?
I certainly haven't seen any cases. I don't think we've gotten that far where someone's been charged for a crime for tweeting.
But could they be charged under this statute?
It says electronic communications. And I think if it's repeated over and over again, then that is possible. I don't see how you could make an argument that it could be kept out.
We've got Judge Don Willett, who is notorious for tweet, or was. Could he have been charged under this statute if someone didn't like his tweets?
What?
Didn't think his jokes were funny?
Well, I think, again, you have to go and look at the intent and that it's a harassment statute. And I don't think that...
So if the defendant here did not intend to harass, then you're saying that it's his subjective intent. It's not the apparent. He can just exonerate himself by saying, "Well, I didn't intend it."
That's something that would have to be proved up by a trial.
And is it intending the harassment, or is it intending the act?
And I think the way I read the statute is that it's the intending the act, like to the intent to...
Intend to send it or intend to harass when you send?
No, intend to harass when you send.
Okay, but wouldn't that force defendants to testify, which they don't have to do at trial, to explain, "I did not intend to harass"?
I don't think so. I think you could cross-examine the police officer on the stand and...
But they can't possibly know what's inside a defendant's head about their intent.
Well, but they can talk about the whatever electronic communications that are at issue in the case. As Justice Southworth mentioned at the beginning, we rely on Scott v. State. And in Scott v. State, that court overruled a First Amendment challenge to the telephone portion of the Texas harassment statute. And the court said there is no First Amendment protection for speech that evades the substantial privacy interests of another in an essentially intolerable way. I think that the thing that court really focused on was the intent there to invade another's privacy and in a manner reasonably likely to inflict emotional distress.
Well, again, they're talking about a telephone.
Right.
And when you're ringing someone's landline at 2 o'clock in the morning, and at 2:30 in the morning, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, and at 3:30 in the morning, that's not talking about the communication. We're just talking about the act of making the phone ring.
Right.
When we're talking about a cell phone, we're talking about the content.
Right.
Not the act of a message appearing on your phone. Because you can take measures to make sure that doesn't harass you. So, I mean, I see a distinction, but... And when you start going to content, then that implicates free speech.
Sure. I think the difference between this statute and statutes that would be looked at as content-based, you know, I think that's what you're getting at, mm-hmm. Justice Sotomayor. Generally, statutes are found to be content-based. I'm basing this off the reasoning in Ex Parte Law, which I cited in my brief. Content-based regulations are those that distinguish favored from disfavored speech based on the idea or message expressed. So here I don't think you're looking necessarily at the idea that someone is trying to express. You're looking at the intent along with that message. In addition to that, content-based regulations operate to restrict particular viewpoints or public discussion of an entire topic or subject matter. That's not the point of this law. They're not trying to the Texas legislature is not trying to prevent discussion of particular viewpoints or a public discussion of an entire topic. They're just saying that if you are going to harass someone, sending them repeated communications, that should be outlawed. And of course, I think very important with this statute is, at least I believe, and I know that the majority, at least the second time the statute was overruled, not the most recent one, but I believe the case was Long Beach State, when the Court of Criminal Appeals reversed the first time. They didn't find a reasonable person standard. I think the reasonable person standard is in there. In other words, going back to what you said again, and I've said this already, but I just want to make sure I'm clear with this. You're right, you can turn the phone off. So if that person has turned that phone off and they're still complaining, well, I keep getting these text messages, or I blocked this call and I keep getting these text messages, then I don't think that you can prove a case under those facts. There have been four courts of appeals. Most recently, after I filed my brief, Ex Parte Scott Ogle, which is a court of appeals case out of Austin, and that was filed on, or rather decided on August 1st, 2018.
Irony.
Yeah. We planned this in advance, by the way. We were, and the petition was filed on August 13, 2018, with the Court of Criminal Appeals. In that Court of Appeals case, is the same as the other two that I already cited, that 4207A7 doesn't implicate the free speech guarantee of the First Amendment. So there have been four Court of Appeals cases that have found that this type of communication is not protected by the First Amendment. As to the second point, or rather to appellant's second point, because this statute is not protected by the First Amendment, he has to show that the statute is vague as applied to him. And he can't do that because we haven't gone to trial yet. You know, there might be certain circumstances, and because I don't think this issue is before the court today. The issue is not before, because the statute actually hasn't been applied to the appellant yet, where it could be unconstitutional. It could be found as unconstitutional as applied to a certain person with certain facts, but we don't have any facts yet. We have argument from the hearings, but we don't have any facts about these particular circumstances. So I don't even think we get to that. And because we don't get to that, because he can't show that the statute's vague as applied to him, then there really is no argument for that, and I don't think that this court can find that it's vague. Alternatively, I can just go through the statute and tell you why I think that it is sufficiently narrow. If you look at Scott v. State, they talked about all the terms: harass, annoy, alarm, abuse, torment, embarrass, offend. All have commonly understood definitions that are relevant in this context. And this is from page 669 in that opinion, note number 13. Harass means to annoy persistently. Annoy means to wear on the nerves by petty unpleasantness. Alarm means to strike fear, et cetera, et cetera. Also, all the terms are narrowed by the fact that harassment must be repeated. And we've kind of already discussed the difference between telephonic communication, the type of communication we're talking about in this case. And the statute makes clear who the victim of the crime is. It's the person receiving the electronic communications. And again, the statute uses a reasonable, at least I believe, the statute uses a reasonable person standard to prevent it from being dependent on each person's sensitivities.
So there's a variation depending upon the sensitivity of the recipient?
No, there is not. I don't believe there is. I think it's an objective standard. I think in each situation, it would have to be would a reasonable person in this victim's position, complainant's position, be offended by or feel harassed by the alleged electronic communications.
And so you measure that by looking at other communications, emails, and texts between the two people?
I think so. I think that that would be a way to show that.
And how far back do you go within the communications between two people like these folks in this case to determine what was their standard of exchange of information?
Are you, Justice Meyer, am I understanding you correctly? Are you talking about the repeated portion of the statute?
I'm talking about two things, the vagueness and the sensitivity of the person receiving it, and also the question of how do you measure whether there was this particular wording in this particular email or text message was offensive.
I think you can look at all sorts of things when you're trying to prove whether a reasonable person would be offended by text messages. You can look at the nature of the relationship. Were they married? Were they going through the divorce? Were they friends? Did they know each other? Was this something they commonly did together? You know, I think all that would come out. In other words, something they commonly did together. Did they joke? Were they joking? Was this serious?
So it really goes to content. You're going back to content. It's not the fact that the thing was sent. It's what it says. That's disturbing to me.
And
because, I mean, what if they just said, how's your day going? 100 times a day. That would be harassing. If they said, how's your day going once? But if they said something vulgar, then all of a sudden it implicates it. So it's what they're saying, not necessarily that they're saying something.
Justice Sedareth, and your point is well taken, and why I don't have the exact case in front of me. I know there is case law out there that states that just because you have to look at the content of a statute or a speech, where First Amendment rights could possibly be involved, doesn't necessarily mean that it's content-based. I think when you go and kind of look at the purposes of the statute, you're trying to stop harassment, you're trying to prevent harassment, you have to go, that person has to be intending to do that, a reasonable person has to be offended in one of the several ways in the statute. So I think it goes further than just looking at the content. I think necessarily you have to see, well, what words were communicated, but it goes more towards what that person's intent was when they were sending it, not the actual words that were used, or it's not trying to stop, in other words, valid communication. It's trying to, sorry,
but,
go ahead.
If you have to look at the party's relationship, whether they banter back and forth, I mean, some people think my husband and I are on the verge of divorce all the time because we're very sarcastic with each other. How is law enforcement supposed to decide who to charge and who not to charge?
Well, I kind of think
prosecutor.
They do.
It has to do with whether or not the victim is mad enough. Doesn't it really just come down to that? Doesn't it just come down to whether there's a squeaky wheel or something goes south in the relationship and they decide to make it something of it?
I see that my time is up.
You can
answer
the question.
I was going to answer the question anyway.
And I didn't mean to step on your toes.
Oh, no, I was through.
Yeah, and I think it just kind of goes back to, what is it reasonable in that situation? Is that, and I think that you may have a police officer who misconstrues the statute and tries to arrest someone when somebody shouldn't be arrested or not, but then I think it goes towards the fact finder to decide whether it's reasonable or not. And I think that's why that's what's so important about this statute, or I think that that's the most important part about the statute when it goes to kind of what we've been talking about today, is that I believe it has a reasonable person standard. And I think that a jury hearing the type of evidence that we're talking about would not find it reasonable in some of these hypotheticals we've been discussing to find a person who was being harassed.
Thank you.
But.
I believe our conversations just now have proven why you guys need to tell the legislature, look, there's just too much open to debate here. This needs to be refined. It needs to be rewritten, as it's done time and time again. As you all know, the legislative history of stalking and harassment statutes have been rewritten several times. And as Carnuff said, they didn't fix it. They may have fixed it in other areas, but they never fixed the language in A7 when they tried to rewrite it to make it fit. And I think our conversations here show we don't know what standard is it. Is it a reasonable person standard? Is it the recipient's sensitivity level? Is there a different standard between roommates, boss and employee, husband and wife? It would seem like there is. It's not uniform. How do we know? So if my boss sends me a text that's harassing, that I think harassing, but he sends the same text to his wife and she accepts it, he's guilty here but not guilty here? I mean, it's just too broad. It's too wide open. And I think our conversation and your questions show that the legislature needs the justices to say, look, it's not good enough. You may have an intent up here, but your intent is not conveyed in the language. And we talked about just now, is it emotional distress, intent to invade? The justices mentioned those types of terms in their opinions. Well, the reason you guys do that is to give the legislature the cue of, okay, rewrite it and say it needs to cause emotional distress, not harass, annoy, whatever. It needs to have a reasonable person standard. It needs to be the recipient standard. It needs all of those things. A couple of things I wanted to touch on just from arguments prior to this. In arguing in front of Judge Vanover, the state actually argued just the fact of sending repeated conversations is annoying. Repeated text is annoying in itself. That was an argument made by the state when we did our arguments in front of Judge Vanover. So as you pointed out, Justice Sutterith, if I send my girlfriend 3 texts a day, hey, I really liked your hair this morning. I really liked the lunch you brought me. Hey, let's go to the movies later. I've sent her repeated texts. So therefore, by the state's own argument prior to today, that is annoying. Because they said, and it's in the record, just the fact of sending repeated communications in itself is annoying. Well, that's a problem. The state also mentioned in their brief that Justice Vanover cited Lebo in sending this case to you guys. He did not actually do that. He states that defense, which in that court was myself, makes a compelling argument. However, the ultimate question this court feels will be best suited for a higher court, which is why we're here today. Justice Vanover said, hey, Tobias, you're bringing up great points. I don't know what annoying means, but let's let it go upside. I will give you leave of the court because I think somebody needs to decide this. Somebody other than me. Justices like you, and if necessary, justices at the state level. Because it is bad law. It's confusing law. Charles didn't know what he was guilty of. We still don't know what he's guilty of. We don't know if it was a communication, and as you mentioned, what might have been legal a year ago is now not legal because they're in a divorce battle. So we've got to then decide what context it's taken in. What communication? Well, maybe today she's mad at me, so now I'm annoying her. I know my moods change day for day. What annoys me today might not bother me tomorrow because I'm happy tomorrow. I got fajitas tomorrow and I missed breakfast today, right? So again, I think you guys, from your questioning to the state, sort of see that this is just sloppy law. It was lazy. They just tried to add in electronic communications because knowing that that's the next thing, but they haven't taken the time to really refine the law to let everyone know, okay, this is a new world we're in, a new means of communication, and we need to know what's okay and what's not okay, whether it's a Twitter, an Instagram, Snapchat, whatever the next thing is, MySpace, Facebook, texts, whether we're beaming signals into each other's brains next, who knows? It's got to evolve, and it's got to be specific. And it's got to be uniform in the way it is enforced by law enforcement. And it's just not. It's not the way it's written right now. It can't be. It's way too vague and it's way too overbroad. And it doesn't take into effect the changes of communication and technology that are going on daily. So for that reason, I would say, you know, teach them a lesson. Tell them how they need to write it. Tell them to fix it. Because I think our conversations today say, yeah, we don't know what this law means. Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments. They've been very helpful to us. Your case has now been submitted. We'll stand in recess until our 10:30 oral argument. Thank you.